Welcome back to the Hemingway List, the podcast where we do things the Hemingway. I've got a real bloody headache today. Real bloody headache. It's very much hurting my brain. It's that kind of headache that starts in your neck, goes all the way around up the back of your neck, and then through the middle of your brain to your eyeballs. And then it hurts your eyeballs. Big apology, I forgot, or didn't, press submit on yesterday's discussion forum. I wrote it all out, got it all ready, and I published the podcast episode. I usually do them at the same time. I do the podcast and then I'll publish the episode or vice versa. But I must have just not clicked publish or forgot to, or maybe I thought I did and didn't. Not really sure. Anyway, today when I sat at my computer, it was actually tonight, I was sat at my computer and noticed that it was just sitting there like an unsubmitted Reddit post. But a big thank you to Techrific, who, as always, has my back, best moderator in the world, jumped in and put up the discussion forum for us. The questions that Techrific asked us about Chapter 10, Part 1 were, so please, hey, discuss this character at your leisure and your general impressions of the chapter. Tomorrow we'll be reading Part 2. Indeed we will be. He also said, I'm sure Ander must have fallen asleep because the podcast was posted, and so I thought I'd jump in and post the discussion thread. Thanks very much, Techrific. You're the best. I am a Norwegian, said, I listened to the audio reading instead of reading the chapter for the first time, being too tired to read. I really should have saved that merge with the realm of unconscious joke until today. Are you saying my reading made you merge with the realm of unconscious? I'm not surprised. I think a lot of people around the world have listened to my podcast, and especially when we did War and Peace, as a method of getting to sleep at night. I noticed that a lot of adjectives in succession made me completely lose grasp on what was going on in the story. Being unable to go back a few lines after Cummings throws a wait, what sentence at you really transforms the book into nonsense. The only thing I remember is Fritz and some other prisoners being freed and a third cook. That's a good point. Being unable to go back a few lines after Cummings throws a wait, what sentence at you really transforms the book into nonsense. All about Alistair, I read this chapter for this exact reason. I feel like I lose way too much trying to listen to it. Might be my reading. I do skim read it a little bit, like I am reading quite quickly some nights. Not every night, but some nights I really try to get through it quick. I think, was last night one of those nights? I can't really remember. But yeah, this is one of those books where the narration, you kind of need to read it because, yeah, when you say it all out loud, it does kind of come across as a bit nonsensey. There are some books that are just written in such a way that they're almost made, the author had bared in mind when they wrote it how it would sound to be read out loud. And there's some books where they obviously have not thought of that. They're two different, very different types of narration. War and Peace was typically written in such a way that you could read it out loud and not miss anything. Then things like The Brothers Karamazov wasn't. There are a lot of paragraph marks in The Brothers Karamazov to mark where someone different was speaking or the gaps in a conversation, but when you read it out loud, unless you're putting on voices, there's really no way to know that someone else is speaking. There's no prompt in the actual narration itself. All About Alice said, wow, so I actually have a lot on my mind with Part 1 of Chapter 10. First, have we discussed the use of Delectable Mountain? It's really grating to me, and I think it's the most jarring thing for me because I have no earthly idea what it refers to. That's a good point, you know. I've just been kind of skimming past that, but what the hell is he talking about, these Delectable Mountains? Is that going to make sense at some point? I looked it up and Google just returned a bunch of hits about a quilt store. That must be it. He's talking about a quilt store. Then I found some references to Pilgrim's Progress, where they discuss the Delectable Mountains, representing the church from the vantage point of a more mature Christian. How does that apply to what Cummings is trying to portray? Surplus was also a strange reference to me. It seems like an especially involved nickname and wouldn't be something that would just come to mind when doling out personality-based tributes. Oh my god. I just realized something. Long pause because I nearly passed out. Oh my god. I could kind of smell something. I'm like, man, something smells a bit in this room. What is that? And then I was like, you know what? It kind of smelled in that other room as well. I kind of got the same, vaguely the same smell. And then I was like, it's been a while since I washed my slippers. I've got these winter slippers. And so I kind of just then took one off my foot and like gave it a little sniff. And oh my god. Oh my god. It smells like a dead animal. Oh, that's good podcasting right there. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to my life. What were we talking about? Oh, God. You don't think to wash your slippers often, do you? I think they probably haven't been washed for a couple of months. Well, probably more. Oh, I think. You know what I think? You know what I think? I'm just going to put them in the bin and buy some new slippers. That's what I think. They smelled that bad. Yeah, that's what I'm going to do. All right, how are you guys enjoying the show so far today? It's a good one. All About Alice also said this. I really feel for this character, Surplice. I'm surprised to feel actual anger towards Cummings, but I really loathe how he portrays Surplice. I'm imagining this guy that gets disgusting from cleaning up other people's waste. In effect, keeping the shared space clean, who then does nothing but exist, only to be ridiculed and tormented by other people because psychologically, we all want to bully people after we've been bullied. It also sounds like Surplice just doesn't know the other languages being spoken around him very well, and how awful is that? You can't really understand what people are saying, you stay away from the women out of actual, I'm assuming, respect, and you wait to be last for everything, only to be treated like a nuisance. I'm sure we've all been there with that person that just tries way too hard to gain approval, but I just can't shake the feeling that Surplice isn't as needy as Cummings makes him out to be. What are your thoughts? As an aside, the reference to going to La Masse for La Masse really hit home for me. I'm prior military, and in basic training, Sundays meant church, which meant sitting down with no one telling you to stay awake. And boy, did you see a bunch of people become good Christians for 6 weeks. Made me chuckle probably a little more than it actually was actually worth. No, that's cool. That's a good little inside look there at, what was it? Mass, La Masse for La Masse. Yeah, about Surplice being bullied like that. Yeah, I don't know. Cummings has become quite cruel towards his character. And I don't know. Is Cummings a dick? It's a good question. I think we should read on with that lens in mind, like that idea of trying to look at him in that way. Is he a dick? You might be right. You might be onto something. I never really thought, you know, it's his book. He's the protagonist. I didn't think he was a dick, but he might be a dick. He very well might be a dick. All right. Let's read on. Let's read the second half of chapter 10. So, the butcher is stooping heavily upon Surplice and slicing and gashing busily and carelessly. His thick lips stuck a little purse-wise, his buried pig's eyes glistening, and in a moment he cries, "Finny!" And poor Surplice rises unsteadily, horribly slashed, bleeding from at least 3 2-inch cuts, and a dozen large scratches, totters over to his couch, holding on to his face, as if he were afraid it would fall off any moment, and lies down gently at full length, sighing with pleasurable surprise, cogitating the inestimable delights of cleanness. It struck me at the time as intensely interesting that in the case of a certain type of human being, the more cruel are the miseries inflicted upon him, the more cruel does he become toward anyone who is so unfortunate as to be weaker or more miserable than himself. Or perhaps I should say that nearly every human being given sufficiently miserable circumstances will from time to time react to those circumstances whereby his own personality is mutilated through a deliberate mutilation of his own part of a weaker or already more mutilated personality. I dare say that this is perfectly obvious. I do not pretend to have made a discovery. On the contrary, I merely state that what interested me peculiarly in this case, in the course of my sojourn at La Ferte, I mentioned that I was extremely moved to find that however busy 60 men may be kept suffering in common, there is always one man, or two or three men, who can always find time to make certain that their comrades enjoy a little extra suffering. In the case of Surplice, to be the butt of everyone's ridicule could not be called precisely suffering, inasmuch as Surplice, being unspeakably lonely, enjoyed any and all insults for the simple reason that they constituted or at least implied a recognition of his existence. To be made a fool of was it to this otherwise completely neglected individual a mark of distinction, something to take pleasure in, to be proud of. The inhabitant of the enormous room had given to Surplice a small but essential part in the drama of Le Misere. He would play the part to the utmost of his ability. The cap and bells should not grace a head unworthy of their high significance. He would be a great fool, since that was his function, a supreme entertainer, since his duty was to amuse. After all, men in La Misere were, well as anywhere else, rightly demand a certain amount of amusement. Amusement is indeed peculiarly essential to suffering. In proportion as we are able to be amused, we are able to suffer. I, Surplice, am a very necessary creature after all. I recall one day when Surplice beautifully demonstrated his ability to play the fool. Someone had crept up behind him as he was stalking to and fro, head in the air proudly, hands in pockets, pipe in teeth, and had, after several heart-breaking failures, succeeded in attaching to the back of his jacket by means of a pin a huge placard carefully prepared beforehand bearing the numerical inscription 606 in vast writing. The attacher, having accomplished his difficult feat, crept away. Soon as he reached his palais, a volley of shouts went up from all directions, shouts in which all nationalities joined, shouts, or rather jeers, which made the pillars tremble and the windows rattle. 6 cent, 6 syphilis. Surplice started from his reverie, removed his pipe from his lips, drew himself up proudly, and facing one after another the sides of the enormous room, blustered in his bad and rapid French accent, Pas syphilis, at which, rocking with mirth, everyone responded at the top of his voice, 6 cent, 6. Whereat, enraged, Surplice made a dash at Pete, the shadow, and was greeted by, Get away, you bloody Polak, or I'll give you something you'll be sorry for. This from the lips of America Lakes. Cowed by as majestic as ever, Surplice attempted to resume his promenade and his composure together. The din bulged. 6 cent, 6 syphilis, 6 cent, 6. Increasing in volume with every instant, Surplice, beside himself with rage, rushed another of his fellow captives, a little old man who fled under the table, and elicited threats of, Go on now, you Polak whore, and quit that business or I'll kill you, upon which he dug his hands into his pockets, into the pockets of his almost transparent pantaloons, and marched away in a fury, literally frothing at the mouth. 6 cent, 6, everyone cried. Surplice stamped with wrath and mortification. C'est dommage, Monsieur Auguste said gently beside me. C'est un bon homme. Le pauvre, il ne fait pas le murderer. Look behind you, somebody yelled. Surplice wheeled, exactly like a kitten trying to catch his own tail, and provoked thunders of laughter. Nor could anything at once be more pitiful and ridiculous, more ludicrous and horrible, be imagined. On your coat, look on your jacket. Surplice bent backward, staring over his left, then his right shoulder, pulled at his jacket, first one way, then the other, thereby making his improvised tail to wag, which sent the enormous room into spasms of merriment, finally caught sight of the incriminating appendage, pulled his coat to the left, seized the paper, tore it off, threw it fiercely down, and stamped madly on the crumpled 606, spluttering and blustering and waving his arms, slavering like a mad dog. Then he faced the most prominently vociferous corner, and muttered thickly and crazily, "Wah, wah, 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 wah." Then he strode rapidly to his palais and lay down, in which position I caught him a few minutes later, smiling and even chuckling, very happy, as only an actor is happy whose efforts have been greeted with universal applause. In addition to being called Syphilis, he was popularly known as Chorpiece, the Pole. If there is anything particularly terrifying about prisons, or at least imitations of prisons such as La Ferta, it is possibly the utter obviousness with which, quite unknown to themselves, the prisoners demonstrate willy-nilly certain fundamental psychological laws. The case of Syphilis is a very exquisite example. Everyone, of course, is afraid of les maladies venerienis. Accordingly, all pick an individual of whose inner life they know and desire to know nothing, whose external appearance satisfies the requirements of the mind, apropos what is foul and disgusting, and having tactily agreed upon this individual as a symbol of all that is evil, proceed to heap insults upon him and enjoy his very natural discomfiture. But I shall remember Syphilis on his both knees, sweeping sacredly together the spilled sawdust from a spittoon box knocked over by the heel of the omnipotent planton, and smiling as he smiled at La Messe when Monsieur Le Cure told him that there was always hell. He told us one day a great and huge story of an important incident in his life, as follows. Monsieur disabled me, yes, Monsieur disabled, I work. Many people, house very high, third floor, everybody, planks up there, planks no good, all shake. Here he began to stagger and rotate before us. Begins to fall, falls, falls, all 27 men, bricks, planks, wheelbarrows, all 10 meters, zzz, 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 pom. Everybody hurt, everybody killed, not me injured. Oui, monsieur. And he smiled, rubbing his head foolishly. 27 men, bricks, planks, and wheelbarrows, 10 meters, bricks and planks, men and wheelbarrows. Also, he told us one night, in his gentle, crazy, shrugging voice, that once upon a time he played the fiddle with a big woman in Alsace-Lorraine for 50 francs a night. C'est la misère, adding quietly. I can play well, I can play anything, I can play n'importe qui. Excuse me. Which I suppose, and guess I scarcely believed, until one afternoon a man brought up a harmonica which he had purchased in Ville, and the man tried it, and everybody tried it, and it was perhaps the cheapest instrument and the poorest that money can buy, even in the fair country of France, and everyone was disgusted. But about 6 o'clock in the morning a voice came from behind the last experimenter, a timid, hasty voice, "Monsieur, monsieur, permettez," and last experimenter turned and, to his amazement, saw Chorpiece the Pole, whom everyone had, of course, forgotten. The man tossed the harmonica on the table with a scornful look, a menacingly scornful look, and the object of universal execration, and turned his back. Syphilis, trembling from the summit of his filthy and beautiful head to the naked soles of his filthy and beautiful feet, covered the harmonica delicately and surely with one shaking paw, seated himself with a surprisingly deliberate and graceful gesture, closed his eyes upon whose lashes there were big filthy tears and played, and suddenly he put the harmonica softly upon the table. He rose. He went quickly to the palais. He neither moved nor spoke nor responded to the calls for more music, to the cries of bis, bujoun, bienju, allez, vaille. He was crying quietly and carefully to himself, quietly and carefully crying, not wishing to annoy anyone, hoping that people could not see that their fool had temporarily failed in his part. The following day he was up as usual before anyone else, hunting for chewed cigarette ends on the spitty, slippery floor of the enormous room, ready for insult, ready for ridicule, ready for buffets, for curses, allures. One evening, some days after everyone who was fit for La Commission had enjoyed the privilege of examination by that inexorable and delightful body, one evening very late, in fact, just before Lumiere's Etienne's, a strange planton arrived in the enormous room and hurriedly read a list of 5 names, adding Demain partis, c'est bonjour, and shut the door behind him. Surplice was, as usual, very interested, enormously interested. So were we, for the names, respectively, belonged to Monsieur Auguste, Monsieur Pétez, the Wanderer, Surplice, and the Spoonman. These men had been judged. These men were going to Presigny. These men could be prisoners pour la durée de la guerre. I've already told you how Monsieur Pétez sat with the frantically weeping Wanderer, writing letters and sniffing with his big red nose, and saying from time to time, "Be a man, Demestre, don't cry, crying does no good." Monsieur Auguste was broken-hearted. We did our best to cheer him. We gave him a sort of last supper for our bedside. We heated some red wine in the tinned cup, and he drank with us. We presented him with certain tokens of our love and friendship, including, I remember, a huge cheese. And then before us, trembling with excitement, stood Surplice. We asked him to sit down. The onlookers there were always onlookers at every function, however personal, which involved food and drink, scowled and laughed. Le con Surplice, sure peace. How could he sit with men and gentlemen? Surplice sat down gracefully and lightly on one of our beds, taking extreme care not to strain the somewhat capricious mechanism thereof, sat very proudly erect, modest, but unfearful. We offered him a cup of wine. A kind of huge convulsion gripped for an instant fiercely his entire face. Then, he said in a whisper of sheer and unspeakable wonderment, leaning a little toward us, without in any way suggesting that the question might have an affirmative answer, "Pour me, monsieur." We smiled at him and said, "Prenez, monsieur." His eyes opened. I have never seen eyes since. He remarked quietly, extending one hand with majestic delicacy, "Merci, monsieur." Before he left, B gave him some socks, and I presented him with a flannel shirt, which he took softly and slowly and simply, and otherwise not as an American would take $1,000,000. "I will not forget you," he said to us, as if in his own country he were more than a very great king. "And I think I know where that country is. I think I know this. I, who never knew Surplice, know." There's a little page break there, and then it says, "For he has the territory of harmonicas, the acre of flutes, the meadows of clarinets, the domain of violins, and God says, why did they put you in prison? What did you do to the people? I made them dance, and they put me in prison." The soot people hopped, and the twinkle like sparks of on the chimney back, and I made 80 francs every dimanche, and beer and wine, and to eat well. Maintenant, c'est fini, et tout suite, gesturing of cutting himself into the tete. And he says, "Oh, you, who put the jerk into joys, come up hither. There's a man up here called Christ who likes the violin." All right, there we go. That is part 2 of chapter 10. I'm a little confused. I don't know what that ending really meant. But hey, have your say over at the subreddit. Thanks very much for listening to today's episode. I will see you tomorrow.